appointed by Truman to the UN. So he used to come back to North Carolina. He had a sister living down on Bow Lane. But one person he'd always come back to see would be my grandmother. And they'd sit on the porch and whatever. I found records and so forth that he helped send my cousin to school, so he gave her money while she was in college, helping her with tuition and whatever. And this would never come out, but I found letters and so forth, you know. And that was the kind of person he was. He followed my career, finishing college. The college that I went to, he was on the board of trustees, you know, in Hampton. So we all sort of went to Hampton, you know. And, you know, while he was there to a trustee, he sort of looked us up and that sort of thing. So I knew I had good connections. If I got in trouble, you know, I knew I had a ace in the hole with the trustee. Okay. I also knew that I had a deep connection. Never undermined the deep connection. Strong. Okay. Even today, it's very strong. Okay. People in positions of power. You know, if my father needed to call somebody, that's what he did, man. And things were done. So, you know, my father made me aware of that deep connection. Okay. I'll just give you an example. I was working in Raleigh, and when Howard Lee left, you know, Howard Lee gave me a job over there. When Howard was no longer over there, the next person coming in wanted to get rid of me. You know, I can understand he wanted to put his people in, but he played games with me. If he had come to me like a man and said, Ed, no harm, but I need to put one of my persons in, would you give me a letter of resignation? And I would have given it to him. They played games with me. Okay. Like I'd go traveling and I'd come back and my desk out in the hall, you know. They took my position away from me, you know. And a lot of other things, man. They were really trying to make it so hard on me that I would leave. They put out that nobody was to talk to me. And we social beings, man, that was the hardest thing in the world, man. I'm sitting there and everybody's scared to talk to me. You know. I said, I ain't gonna resign. I'm not gonna resign, okay? I ain't gonna let him do that to me. You know, white man, I'm black. You know, I have my dignity. I'm not gonna let him do that. They had a Christmas party, and they marched everybody in the department up to the new secretary's office, man. And he shook everybody's hand and welcomed them. They had punch and cookies. Well, when I got there, man, he turned his back on me. And, well, everybody there saw it. So that was the beginning of breaking down, because people said, man, this is not right. I don't care who it is. I will talk to you, and I don't think that's the way it should be. There was a lady there that told him off. She had 30 years in, so she could retire anyway. She told him, you know, I'm going to talk to Ed. I'm gonna support him. I don't like the way you're doing this. Okay. Well, Bobby got so bad, man, that with the games that they were playing, I went to Ben Ruffin, who was the minority person. You know, and Ben told me, nothing you could do, man. That was the governor's childhood friend, you know. And ain't nothing I can do, man. You know, best thing I know you to do is resign. So I ain't resigned. Okay? I ain't going nowhere. Okay? So I called. I didn't tell my father, but he knew something wrong with me. So I went to one of the deacons, Kenneth Ross, Senator Kenneth Ross, most powerful man in state government. Okay, nothing happened over there unless Kenneth said it happened. That's when, you know, they were very strong. Okay. The governor couldn't get his budget through, man, if Kenneth said it ain't going to the General Assembly. And so I talked with Senator Ross' son, and he said, go talk to my father. And so I went and talked with Senator Ross, and I said, I need your help. You know, this man, Joe Grimsley, is, you know, really making it hard on me, you know, and I can't take it no more. And I'm asking you to do something about it. Well, you know, Senator Ross says, Eddie, you know, there's a separation between the legislative and the administration, you know, and I don't want to get involved. So I looked at Senator Royal in the eye and said, Senator Royal, what are you telling me? That you're not going to help me? You're not going to help little Eddie? You're deep. I don't understand this. Tell me, you know, are you going to help me or you're not going to help me? Okay? Now, Senator Royal, I'm going to be very honest with you. What are the other dicks going to say if you didn't help little Eddie? Okay? Now you just tell me, are you going to help me or not? He said, Eddie, pretty strong. Okay? You write up what needs to, you know, so that I can know. So he called the governor's person and said, I want y'all to leave little Eddie alone. Okay? I don't want to hear that y'all are doing these games on him, okay? Well, they stopped Bob for about 3 or 4 weeks. Then they started again. Okay? I called Senator Roy and said, Senator Roy, they started again. So he got in touch with the governor's person and they said, well, we're going to transfer him. They drew up an agreement of understanding, and I got transferred to another department, and they made this thing sound official, and I had this position, and whatever, you know. And that's what happened. And I was saw Ben Ruffin, and he said, how were you able to pull this off? I said, Ben, you couldn't help me. Yeah. Somebody could. And he was amazed that I had this thing. He said, what kind of connections you got? I said, don't worry about it. And nobody bothered me from now on. So the word got put out, man. You know, the word started circulating real fast. Okay. Nobody messes with him. He's got political connections. So I never tell nobody. And I never use that. I only use it when I have to. I mean, I never went to a deep to say, you know, this is what I want. No, I work for what I want, okay? But if I need to use connection, that's what I would do. I got the executive director for the Housing Finance Agency resigned. Okay? He called me in and said, I'm resigning. This is hush hush. The board wants to appoint you. Okay, are you willing to serve? And I said I was. Well, that was best well kept secret because at the next meeting, he offered his letter of resignation. And the board sort of went into executive session to see who they were going to appoint. I already knew who they were going to appoint. They were going to appoint me. We had underwriters and bond counsel from Wall Street, New York, because we sold bonds. And they were trying to figure out, well, who's going to be the next interim executive director? They were lobbing everybody, all the white, that they thought may get appointed. And I'm sitting there on the wall, everybody talking to me. I'm just sort of watching the dynamics. Okay? I mean, they just knew they weren't going to appoint no black man. That agency had $2 billion portfolio to manage. They ain't going to put nobody like me in charge of all that money and stuff. So I just sort of watched. And when they came back, they made the announcement that we appointed Leah Caldwell. The place almost went, wow. The bond underwriters panel had lobbied and talked to the wrong people, so automatically they stopped talking to them and they started coming and talking to me. Congratulations, we're going to work with you and whatever. And so I said, okay. I mean, I ain't no fool. I need their help.
But your feelings were hurt?
Yeah, I was hurt. We just didn't know. We just didn't think that I would be perfect. It was a business thing. I had some of the administrators that I had worked with. I ain't gonna work for you. I ain't work for no black man. I just can't work for you. I like you here, but I just, in my history, I just can't work for you. One guy, I told him, I said, look, tell you what, why don't you go home over the weekend? You come back Monday, you tell me whether or not you can work for me. I want you to have all weekend to think about it. If you can't work for me on Monday, then I'll accept your resignation. If you talk it over with your wife, your kids, everybody, we'll meet on Monday. And this guy said, I thought about that. I just bought a house. I got a mortgage. I just bought a beach house. Man, I need a job. I'll work for you. One guy just refused to work. Yeah, I just can't work for you. Everybody was telling him, man, and they were working on him. He was supporting his mother, and he had a brother who had multiple sclerosis or something. He was the sole support. And he was just stubborn. He ended up working because he needed the job. I have a tough time, man. Because even though they said that they would work for him, they sabotaged me. So I would fail. But going back to the deconnection, somebody in one of the financial institutions put the word out, that we want you to make sure the kids succeed. I had the backing, everybody in government, everybody in the banks, whatever. They were going to make sure that I succeeded. The bond counsel and underwriters, man, they came to my rescue. They helped me. We were supposed to sell some bonds. I was unsure it wasn't a good time to sell bonds and stuff. And we put it together, and we sold them. So I had from the board of directors anybody that didn't want to work for me to fire. I only had to let one person go. Young lady. She wasn't working anyway.
messed up, you know, and caused us a money, man, and I terminated him. That caused a lot of, a lot of mixed emotions about that. Black man find white person. But, you know, I had John Crosby. He was a builder. The second builder in the state in my corner. And nobody was going to love against me. And she just had to go. But, you know, I saved that agency. It was difficult, Bob. I'm telling you, it was difficult.
What I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you grew up in a situation where your family had a fair amount of interaction with whites, where there was little or less, shall I say, prejudice in the prejudice sound. And then you went to work in the state government and worked like that. Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
Say that again.
That you grew up in a family where there was a lot of interaction with white, black,
right?
There was either little or less prejudice that you saw with your dad and the Dukes and your Mrs. Neal working the brands. And then in the rest of your world, especially when you went to work, it wasn't that way.
That's right. But I understood that. I understood that. I mean, I worked over here at Research Triangle Park. Okay, and that company from chemistry and moved in from Alabama. Okay. You know, and they had to have at least a few blacks in order to keep them government contracts. Okay. That was a difficult situation. Here was I supposed to be professional, walking down the hall, you know, who gonna speak to you or who weren't. And some people would speak to you and some wouldn't. Majority wouldn't. So you had to be ready. Somebody spoke to you, say, hey, how you doing? You know, that sort of thing. You go to the dining hall and sit at the table, man, and have everybody get up, especially ladies. I sit down, you know, they down at the end. If I sit down and eat my dinner, they get up and move to another table. I mean, that was a difficult situation. I had a few friends, you know, one guy in particular, very bright young man, he was a genius, 160-some-odd IQ. Never finished college, just bright. And we got to be good friends. I always encouraged him, man, Jim, go back and get your degree, man. If you can't make it, man, I'll be about your degree. And he just said, I can't sit in no class. He was smarter than most of the professors. He was definitely smarter than the guy that he was working for. He had a PhD and he had to work for him. But I talked to him. Became very good friends. I went out to help him work on his house. Boy, could do anything. He was the only person that I knew that not only had a very bright mind, but he could work with his hands. I mean, Jim sit down and he'd think for a while. He had five kids, okay? And he needed the money. And he was remodeling MGs and that sort of thing. And he looked at the thing and said, they designed this thing wrong. And he would go in and he would do something else. I mean, he'd just sort of sit and paint and then draw it up. You know, Jim was bright. I went and helped Jim with his house. And people saw me over there helping Jim. Nobody else could help him. And the Ku Klux Klan burned a cross in his yard. Okay? And he said, I'm not going to let them you know, tell me, I'll fight it.
What year was that?
It was in the 60s. So we became very good friends. He helped me work on my cars, get me work on housing projects and so forth that I had. I remember, you know, Jim worked in the lab right next to me. And I remember Jim saying, it was Christmas time, are you going to go to the Christmas party? And I said, well, I think I'm going to the banquet, but I don't want to go to the dance. So me and my wife went to the banquet. Okay. And they had discouraged any other blacks from coming. You know, they're talking about it. They sort of let it be known, man, that their job may be in jeopardy if they went to this thing. Well, they had these things at some of the better country clubs in Raleigh that had a policy, man, of not integration. Okay. And they asked me if I was going. I told them, yeah, it's part of my salary. Okay. You know, they're giving you all these gifts, and they're giving you this dinner, and, you know, and y'all eating some of the best food, I'm going. Yeah. So Jim said, good for you. And so we went to the banquet and whatever, and when they got ready to go to the dance, he said, Ed, you going to the dance? I said, no, I don't think I'm going to the dance. He said, well, why not? I said, well, I don't want to dance with my wife all night long. Yeah, you going to let me dance with your wife? He said, yeah, you dance with my wife. My friend, and he meant the thing. And so when we got ready to go in there, they said there ain't no more tables. Okay, so we put up a table on the outside of the dance of the banquet, and me and his family and my family sit out there. And because of that, you know, me and Jim came very, very close. From then on, we were very close. But no, I participated in everything. Bowling league, they say, you gonna bowl? I said, yeah, I'm bowling. Is this a company sponsored thing? Yeah, I'm bowling. I was a thorn, because they couldn't do things the way that they always had done them. Okay? I played tennis. Say you're gonna play tennis. Bill Blackburn. I don't know if you remember Bill, president of the club. Bill worked out there. Bill was the one that interested me in joining the tennis club as well as playing on the tennis team of the company. Well, they had to find different places to play. Could no longer play at the country club, you know. So they had to find public courts to play. You know, I was a nuisance. Other blacks refused to go to things. We had Santa Claus there. I carried my kids. If they were passing out basketballs and gifts and whatever, sure, I'd be taking my kids. Okay. But none of the other blacks would do it. Okay. So, you know, it was difficult. You know, really difficult working for Monsanto. I do recall there was one young lady that just would not speak. It wouldn't speak at all. She came to a black club. Okay. I guess they call themselves slumming. And in Durham, came to this black club. And that was a fella that worked with me out at Kempston. And he said, Ed, you're not going to. You're going to be surprised, you know, who's sitting up in this club. This woman there, and she and her boyfriend and some others that wouldn't speak. I said, really? I went over and asked them to leave. I said, y'all are not welcome in here. See, you can start speaking to me in the hall at work, but you can't come in this club. I put them out. Put them out. and they left. Well, you know, too many blacks in there, man, started something. And from then on, she started to speak. I don't know why this guy didn't go over that door. They just sort of looked to me as a leadership person, man, to do certain things. You know? And that's pretty much what I was doing. So I've rambled.
That's great. I want to go back to a couple of things you described. You mentioned that there were friendships in the black community with the white community when you were growing up.
Right.
And where did those friendships start? How did they occur?
I think they started from sports. We all used university. There were no recreation in town. You know, white kids used university for their recreation. We used it too. White kids used it, we gonna use it. I mean, we knew them. I mean, this town was too small, man, not to know everybody in town. We knew all the kids, man, with the Chevrolet High, whatever. I mean, you know, just walk the street, we knew them. We went to all their football games, and they came to our football games, right? And we sort of prepared notes and that sort of thing. So we just, I mean, they were interested in us, we were interested in them. During the summer, we had some Cinder Pro teams. They had a white Cinder Pro baseball team, and we had a black Cinder Pro baseball team. And they'd come to our games and we'd go to theirs, and you know, they would give us pointers. Okay? You know, and we arranged to play a baseball game, you know, whites versus the blacks. Okay, they beat the hell out of us. Okay. They beat us to death, okay? I mean, they were in a different category, man. But, see, you gotta understand, Bob, any player that played at Carolina played with this white Cinder Pro team during the summer. They had the best pitcher, they had the best, they were good, okay? They were just in a league by themselves, man. And, and, you know, we had a ragtag, you know, high school kids and whatever, we could play with them. But we played. Okay? And that was friendship. I guess you heard Coach Linden, when he was at Central, played some players for Duke. Okay? And they had integrated games and so forth going on, so we had an integrated team, you know. And we made sure that we played at least one game a year. We still never could beat them, you know, not with the college kids and so forth.
How often did this interaction take place with the sports, with the blacks and the whites?
Every year, all the time, all the time.
Once a week or?
Yeah, mostly on the weekend. Like, mostly on Sundays, we'd all go to see Carolina play on Saturday, and we'd arrange a game for Sunday. Some of the football players, you know, that played for Carolina used to arrange these games for us. They brought all the football equipment and stuff from the gyms and so forth, and they referee. You know.
What about the women, the black men and the white men? I can see how the black man and white men would become friends in competition. What about the women?
But what about? Now, Bob, now
did they interact?
No.
Not at all?
Very little, I would imagine. A lot of the black women
did babysit and do housework in White House, but I don't think that the, I don't recall black women, and, you know, from my high school being friends with any of the white women. White women were, if you really want to think about it, was the most controlled person during that time. White women knew, man, that they weren't supposed to speak, be friends with both black and white, whether it was male or female, just to do those sorts of things. And, it was known that black men weren't supposed to have any contact with black women, white women. And now, in friendships with males, became strained if white women were around. Okay. I mean, you know, that was, you just knew that. Well, that's just the way it was. You know, I don't know what else to say.
It works,
yeah. I think after the 60s and integration, you found a certain amount of mingling. There were a lot of white women that came down from the North, and some of the white colleges that came down to help register, voter registration and voting. There was some interracial parties and that sort of thing. One of the things is, I was a leader at the time, and when they came down, you know, I just said there's gonna be no interracial parties. Right? Well, let me make it clear, our number one objective, man, was to get people registered to vote. I was not going to permit something like that getting in the way and preventing, you know, our goals of registering people and getting them to vote. Now, if you want to come down and work, whatever, that's fine. Okay. Now, if you want to go somewhere and do something afterwards, man, that's up to you. But I'm not going to have people coming down from the North with their whole thing, man, is to party. That's not what we, you know, not why we bring you down. So, you know, that was, we had to do a certain amount of that, okay? Just to keep them from hurting, you know, what we were trying to accomplish.
I wanted to get back to one other thing, and that is that you mentioned the conversations that took place on the back porch in the summertime and in the kitchen in the wintertime. Do you remember what kinds of things you discussed or what you overheard growing up in those conversations?
A lot of family history, a lot of jokes, a lot of stories. Blacks don't write very much, but they pass family history orally. I am considered the historian in the black community. I just haven't written it down. But all the stories, I was a listener. All the stories that my grandmother had talked about, man, is there. Her experiences of growing up as a child, her experiences and so forth. The experience of when they were building the school and the difficulties of them putting substandard building materials in the school.
and all that entail. You know, like the, they were about to build a black and white school at the same time. I think the Howard School cost something like $22,000. White High School cost $102,000. And the fights and struggles that they had just to try to get comparable things, you know, put in our school. And when they had a cost overrun, you know, then they put it in the White High School. When there were budgets and so forth, shortfall, they closed the black schools. Okay. Schools weren't open, but for 6 weeks at the time. They opened late because the farmers said to the school board member, we need you not to start the black schools until the crop got in. So we didn't have no school. White kids going to school, we didn't have no school, man, until the crop got in. And then, you know, the school term was no more than about 6 to 8 weeks. Okay. if the money ran short, they closed the school. The white school, but they closed the black school. So I remember my grandmother and them talking about the injustices and so forth. Okay. So all those stories were just churning. Okay. All the things, man, they did to us. So when I went on school board, my number one objective, man, is to correct things that had happened, you know. And I guess that was one of the reasons I was effective as a school board member. I didn't go on board to make sure that black kids got things. I felt that I would push things. What's good for black kids, white kids is good for black kids, and if we could make sure that everything was equal, man, then black kids were going to benefit. And that was my objective. Okay. Some things that they had done, you know, that were still practices and so forth, I went in there and I made sure that those things got corrected. So, you know, that was, I think that I grew up with a lot of anger, because, I mean, we were really shafted, man, from an educational standpoint. We just did not have the materials, you know, that the white kids had. I mean, it's very obvious, you know, that we didn't. One of the things that they used to say was, you know, black kids tore up things, tore up the books, tore up the desks. And I used to always repeat this thing at meetings. You know, I tell them, man, they said we tore up desks and tore up books. The books were tore up before we got them. Okay? The janitors and so forth worked at the White High School. Okay. I used to pass White High School going to work at the Deke House. And I remember them taking those old desks and stuff out, man, and the white kids getting new desks and they sending all that old broken down stuff over there to us. I mean, the books, you know, when they assign a book, you put your name in it. At a place in the very beginning where you put your name in it. Over here they put new, good, fair, poor. But when the books got to us, man, they were poor. Okay? And we knew all the kids. We knew all the white kids. We knew them by name. And we look in the book, man, you know, Fennel McGinnis, you know. And they're going to tell us, man, that we tore up these books, man. These books tore up before we got them. And I said, we don't have no blacks named Fennel McGinnis, you know. That was Mac McGinnis, you know. No, we don't have no guys in our school named Fennel McGinnis, man. You know, so I knew all these kids, man. Don't tell us we tore up nothing. You know, we cherish things. Our PTAs brought the books to go in the library. And we had sellings, man, to supplement things that the city and the county didn't give us. Okay. And that's how we were able to do certain things. We had Mr. Mason, what was his first name? He was the guy working at for the Carolina football team. Not Charlotte Mason. Anyway, Morris Mason.
Morris Mason.
Morris Mason. Okay. Hey. You know, when they took the cleats off, Mr. Morris Mason, you know, you're supposed to take the cleats off when they got down to certain areas. Mr. Morris took those cleats off, man, and sent them over there to us, man, before, you know, they were supposed to. That's where we got our equipment. Mr. Morris Mason, man, he sent us our equipment and stuff, you know? I mean, he took helmets out of circulation, man, before the time and sent it over there to us. We couldn't buy no football uniform, man. It's a wonder we didn't get killed out there playing in that stuff, man, that we had. We may be able to buy 5 new uniforms a year, you know, but there are 11 people on the team. So when we go out there, man, none of our uniforms match. Except 1 year, we played the state champion for Virginia, Roanoke, Virginia. Okay. Our colors were orange and black, but when we went to play Roanoke, Virginia, our uniform was Carolina blue. Mr. Morris Mason got them uniforms, man, from Carolina. And we went, and we played in them uniforms, but we had to get them back, you know, after the game was over, you know.
The university.
No, you know. You know. But, you know, that's how we were able to get over.
Well, this is great. This is going on maybe a little longer than I wanted it to, but you're terrific. Your memory is fantastic. You're giving me a lot of wonderful stuff. Why don't we stop?
Okay, be fine.
All right. I hope I didn't overrun.